Okay. Thank you, Kelly. That was great. I have, again, I'm Julie WW and I'm an alcoholic. And I was asked to introduce our speaker today, which is an honor. I always get excited when I'm going to hear Sal speak because I always learn something about him. You know, no matter how long we're sober, we remember something and go, ah, and that comes out in the story. And Sal is very good at that. Sal, I have known for years, and he is more about service and service work than any person that I know of. I don't think I've ever heard him say no when somebody's asked to do something, and that is a good quality of sobriety. One thing that I really admire about Sal is the way that he supports Club 12. And not only at anniversary times, and this is a huge anniversary that we're supporting, but in other times throughout the years, Sal has supported Club 12 in many ways. And one of them is by putting together amazing, talented groups of people to put on a drag show and have a wonderful entertainment with great performers. And the latest drag show that Sal and his friends put together was the Quarantine Queens. And if y'all didn't see it, you missed it. And that little drag show online by Zoom, it raised over $4,000 for Club 12's anniversary. So I'm just proud to know Sal. He's got it going on. I love Sal. He's a good friend of mine. And so with that, I want to introduce Celso Z.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Cel, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 20th of 2007, and for that, I'm truly grateful. I have to keep the glare off my glasses so you can see my beautiful eyes. I'm just kidding. Just so that you can see me right without all this glare. So is this good? All right. I want to thank Dave for being the voice, Suzanne for asking me to speak. It is always an honor and a privilege that I get to say yes when somebody asks me to be a service. I really enjoy being able to share my experience, strength, and hope, mainly because I get to hear what had happened to me and what it was like, and I get to tell you guys what a miracle it is to stay sober now. Specifically today, I do want to thank Club 12, and I really want to thank the old timers who keep your seat warm and who keep the door open, and who without, it would basically be like a psych ward full of newcomers coming in, unsupervised. So I'm so glad that there were people with good, rich, long sobriety that showed me what to do and how to do it. So I really thank you guys there. I also want to do a shout out to my Breakfast Club peeps. I get to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and get, pull a comb through my hair and get a hot cup of coffee, and I get to sit in front of a computer and share the morning with you guys. It's me, you, a cup of coffee, and God's world. And I'm there every morning at 7 a.m. and 8 o'clock on the weekends. The Breakfast Club has become my new home group in about late June, early July, because I needed to stay connected. And I found that by making a meeting first thing in the morning, I have some strong footing to hold on to during these very uncertain times. So I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, everybody, for are doing service work to put this anniversary on. I will tell you that I miss conferences. I miss anniversaries, potlucks. I love outreach. I love H&Is and going out and carrying the message. I love to speak at conferences. I love traveling to go see my friends. I love picking up my friend Solis on the way to picking him up in Austin as we head to the Houston Roundup. And I love throwing the newcomers in. That's why I have like SUVs, because I throw newcomers in the car. And we get going on the road and we listen to sober speakers and we have a good time and we just blow it off. And, you know, it's been, and I'm already emotional, but it's been really hard to not do that. And it has been even more important for me to be grounded in what I'm doing. Like here, I get to speak tonight again at 9 p.m. in California. And I get to stay connected the best way that I can to keep myself safe, my dad safe, and mainly you guys safe. So I'm so glad to be here. And gosh, I miss you. A couple times a month, I go out to my sponsor, Julie WW's house, and we go to, we call it Club Patio. I usually bring burgers from the Longhorn Cafe, which are the bomb, and some onion rings and French fries, tater tots, cheese fries. And we go and we just eat our feelings. And that's okay. We're from Texas. We can eat our feelings. I was told early in sobriety, I think I gained like 70 pounds my first year of sobriety. And I was like, oh my God. And this woman named Ramona at the La Hacienda Group, when it used to meet off of Wurzbach, the original, they had a really comfortable chairs. One of the reasons why I liked and I was real thick. I was real thicky back then. And I remember going into the meeting, and just Ramona came in with these Krispy Kreme donuts. She had this fabulous hair and this like super sterling black Jaguar with everything on chrome polished. I just thought, man, I want my program to look like that. And she came in with Krispy Kremes and I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna eat another 1,000 calories during the meeting. And she said, what's wrong, honey? And I said, I cannot stop eating. You know, I'm trying. And she's like, oh honey, don't you know the rule? You can eat anything you want in the first year of sobriety. You can always lose the weight, but you may not be able to come back and pick up a desire chip. So eat whatever you want. And of course, at 13 years later, I'm like, I think Ramona was right. I think we need to extend another year. So anyway, I want to thank Terry for an awesome share. That was so good. I told her on break, I was telling her that I had to reapply my concealer 2 more times because I was crying all the way to the end of the story. I also want to thank Rick, who kicked us off last night. Rick, because that's his name, Rick. Super great story. I love his energy. I love that he went to jail and that he became a minister when he got out. I love stories like that. Those are the stories that blow my hair back. It is absolutely, the shining star. When I hear, I love going to conferences. I love speaker meetings. I love speakers. I love people who share from the heart at the podium. It allows me to speak my truth. And in turn, I get to allow the newcomers to speak their truth. Beautiful message. I want to say it's really good to see my friends, Ms. Sarah and King and Dan and Zechariah, and of course, Callie and Pearl and all my peeps. Without you, I would be nothing, literally. I was told in early sobriety that you need them, Sal. They don't need you. So why don't you keep your shares to 3 minutes or less? So anyway, tonight I get to share my story. And I get to share what I used to be like and also what happened. And then what I'm like now and what the program has done for me and what the program can do for you. If you are newly sober, my share is always for you. The story that I bring in, because we don't wish to shut the door on our past, is it doesn't belong to me anymore. It's like when I tell my what it was like, it's like talking about a stranger who's not even here anymore. It sounds like somebody who's gone. When I share what it's like now, I am reminded how grateful I need to be not to wake up in the back alley, in the back of a police car, in the living room of somebody's house, in my car, or on lockdown for 26 years, which was certainly the story that I had when I came in. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like and where I come from. My birth mother, my dad, I love my dad. He's been my ride or die. It's always been him and me for, I am 49 years old. It's been him and me for 49 years, even today. He's actually next door in the room, or he's in the tool house, like building something. He's super active. He's off military. He was in the military when he was in Vietnam. I think he was on a second or third tour. And my birth mother was a chronic alcoholic, a partier. All her friends were like gay leather bikers and banditos. And my mother chain smoked cigarettes and a whole bunch of stuff I didn't know when I came in. I didn't even know that I had another mother because my grandmother picked me up at age 3 in Phoenix, Arizona. And we come from a very, very poor Mexican family. And my mom would lock me in a closet and then she would party. And she locked me in the closet so that nobody would take advantage of me or steal me away when she would black out. And my dad would be in Vietnam fighting. And my dad doesn't have a problem with alcohol. He never has really touched it in the last at least 15 years. And when he did, when I was in high school, he barely had a few. He's one of those, he's a really good Al-Anon. He likes to stay in control. My grandmother down to pick me up from Phoenix is my mother was partying. She was drinking Jack Daniels, which I know it's Super Dave's like favorite alcohol of choice. And she would drink Jack Daniels and she would pass out. And what had happened was is that I wrapped a rubber band around my hand. I was 3 years old. And then my hand swelled and it turned blue and I started screaming and the neighbors called the police and they came in. And that's my only memory from childhood for my birth mother, my only memory. I was taken away. 2 days later, my grandmother is flown down. My dad sneaks my grandmother onto my dad's in the Air Force. And so they snuck my grandmother on one of those freight bombers or whatever. And she came down to pick me up and then snuck me. I remember being in this big hollow cargo plane back to San Antonio. And while my dad was in the field in Vietnam. And I remember I clung to my, I don't remember my grandmother. I just knew that she was safe when she came in and I jumped in her arms and I wouldn't leave her side the whole flight back all the way. If I had to go to the bathroom, if she had to be right next to me, like it was, I would cry outside the door when she had to go potty. And then it was just like that. And then I'm, basically an only child. Just me and my imagination at 3 years old. And then we land in San Antonio and I come into a house with 8 aunts, 32 cousins, food cooking, all this sensory. And I didn't speak for 6 months and I was 3 years old. So at 3 and a half, I didn't know how to communicate, with others and I didn't know how to communicate with my family because I had been so sheltered and I had been locked in a closet for quite a long time. And, so when I come into this house and, I finally start blending and because there's fun and there's food, there's lots of really good food and there's always like a pot of beans cooking. And, my grandma has like a 3-bedroom house, like with an extended mix at the back, with, all my cousins, I have 8 aunts and an uncle and everybody has kids. And so I have 32 first cousins. And so, we come from very fertile women. You look at one of my aunts and they're pregnant like that. One of my cousins too. That's just being Mexican and not practicing birth control. So anyway, lots of good stuff I want to get to. And that is, I was raised like that. My dad slowly, came back into my life and my grandmother told my dad, I'm going to raise him, but when he's ready for you, I'm going to let you know. And so you need to slowly integrate yourself back in here. And he was back. He was getting ready to leave the military. He wanted to be a good dad. All my aunts and everybody has a family. It was me and my cousin Liz who were the only single parents, you know, and I kept saying, Grandma, where's my mom? Everybody has a mom, but I don't have a mom. And she was like, I'm your mom. And so I would just say, my grandma's my mom. Like, you know, I would just say Grammy or anyway. So, it's the only real place I ever felt safe in my entire life. I could have used a drink about 3.5 or 4. But I took my first drink at age, 13. I think I was in a quinceañera and they were taking for anybody who doesn't know what a quinceañera is, it's a sweet 15 birthday and everybody is allowed to get drunk and all the kids have to dress up in really tacky clothes and somebody gets in a fight in the parking lot. That's what a quinceañera is. Okay. Everybody had champagne glasses with all these like kids, you know, and I had a champagne glass. I was always really tall and I always looked a little bit older. I could get away with a lot. And while they were filling everybody's glass and everybody's acting funny, I would sip it down. I'd be like, oh, my glass. And I had 3 glasses while I was trying to take that picture. And, cause it was sophisticated and there was bubbles. And, you know, if you saw people hold the champagne glass like this with their finger out, like, you know, and I was like, this is so sophisticated. I'm so fancy. And you know, as a young gay boy, I just felt like naturally this is a perfect hand for a cocktail. Anyway, so I remember feeling just like I think Rick said it perfectly Friday night. My shoulders relaxed. I exhaled for the first time. It's like somebody plugged in the Christmas tree and everything made sense. You know, it just like, I felt comfortable. I felt at ease in my skin and I hadn't felt like that in 13 years. And it just made sense to me. It just made sense. It began a love affair with alcohol and many other things. But it just made every situation perfect. And I stopped that over and over again. I had my first drink. My dad remarried a lot. I have a mom who adopted me and she raised me and she did the best that she can. I was hell on wheels. And if I wasn't around my grandmother, I was not happy. My dad did the very best that he can and he exited the military so he could spend more time with me and started some businesses and was working. And my dad had been married 4 times, going on the 5th time. And so I was married into a brother, a stepbrother, a stepsister. I have a sister who my mom is raising, my adoptive mom is raising. And, you know, I just felt, you know, as you mature and you start going through puberty, and I just was like, I mean, I've been gay since like I came out of my mom's womb, just FYI, if you're wondering. And, you know, it was really hard in the 80s and especially the late 70s and early 80s. The only time I really felt safe and was my grandmother, and she made a safe place for me to express myself and all that fun stuff. And just a safe place. And I get to, you know, I get to experience like life in the 80s as this young kid trying to come out and trying to grapple with his identity. And, you know, alcohol just made it okay. It made everything okay. And so I sought that. Consequences came fast and early. I would sneak cars out. I would wreck them. There would be people involved. There was kids that were hurt and, insurance companies that were sued and, you know, and my dad not knowing what to do. And there was divorces and I would run to my grandmother's house when everything was bad and I would just hang out there and, you know, and then my dad would, and this is what happened. My dad would polish me up. Everything's fine. If we look good on the outside, everything will be fine on the inside. And, you know, as time went on, this is my dad's job became to make sure that I didn't die and that he did everything he could possibly do for me not to go to jail. And, then things would be okay. you know? And then I had that thought that would come through that, like the Big Book says, if I only had whiskey with a cup of milk, a glass of milk, that couldn't hurt me. I'd be fine. That worked so well. I had another one. And then I had another one. And then I had another one. And then I went to the asylums. You know, I was at my first rehab with a possession of cocaine and in high school. And I was tackled during first period. And all this cocaine came out of my, I mean, it looked like a cloud. I had just partied for like my 16th birthday, and my boyfriend and his dad were like major drug dealers and smuggler. They did everything. And I learned how to navigate through the drug world that way. And I remember very well that my dad came in and, you know, the police were there and he talked to me out. We're going to rehab right now. Went to my first rehab. It had hot rock massage, you know, and heated saunas and pools and Luby's cafeteria style food. And I was like, this is more my style, you know. Like, now this is where the party's at, is this rehab. Okay. And things got better. And then I got some freedom, and I took that freedom and I ran with it. So it was over and over and over again. And my dad sat me in the parking lot at age, God knows what, 20 something. 26, 27. He said, I can't watch you kill yourself anymore. I won't be part of it. You get $200 a month to put food in your stomach. And other than that, that's the best I can do. I need to go. And he took off and he moved to Mexico and he did his spiritual journey that he needed to go take care of himself. He's never stepped foot in the rooms of Al-Anon, but he had strong Native American spiritual guides to tell him, hey, let your son go on his path. And he did. And I took that opportunity to become a unlicensed pharmaceutical representative. And with singleness of purpose, for AA singleness of purpose, I do want to keep it about alcohol because, and no doubt that alcohol was absolutely the ticket. There was not a time that I got in trouble that alcohol was not involved. There was not a time that I had the best feeling in the world and alcohol was not in my hand. What makes me an alcoholic is that I have a desire to stop drinking and that I know that I am, that one is too many and a thousand is not enough. I know that. So at that time, as a pharmaceutical rep with no license, I went underground for 10 years and there was not a time that I didn't look over my shoulder. There were not people, my friends, and was I not friends to a lot of people? It was the darkest time of my life. I played by a different set of rules. I didn't care what you straight people said. I didn't care what society said. I learned how to maneuver in the belly, underbelly of drugs and alcohol. And it's just where I felt like I could thrive. And I did. I did whatever I wanted to do. I had money. I had things. I had shiny stuff. I had crunchy alcohol, as my friend Solis likes to say. I had liquid alcohol. I had powdery alcohol. I had alcohol in tablet form. I had it all. And, then came the day where I looked at myself in the mirror and I was like, who are you? You know, who is this person? And I remember thinking, because my grandmother had passed when I was about 21, and I thought, this is not how your grandmother raised you. You had aunts that showed you love, fed you, and showed you how to open the door for people. I came from a house in a place where my grandmother had a vela, which is a candle. Virgen de Guadalupe is her saint, and she had the candle on, and I would go try to blow it out all the time, and she's like, no, mijo, don't blow out the candle. This place, is God's house, and in case somebody loses their way home, they know to come here. Like, that's what kind of Catholic home I grew up in. It was safe. I would lock the doors because I knew that there was safety in locking doors. And she would say, no, we don't leave the doors unlocked because one of God's children may need a place to stay. So we keep the door open so they can come in. You're safe here. She would say that. You're safe here. And, I was raised better, but alcohol and drugs told me what I was going to do, when I was going to do it, and who I was going to do it to and with. And no family member, no frothy emotional peel that would stop me from getting what I needed. I needed my medicine. It worked until it stopped working. And this is what happened. I just needed one more for the road. I was up for several days. If it's 3 or more days, Stacey has taught me, you can say it's several days. I've been to several places, institutions. I've been up for several days. And at this point, I just needed one more drink for the road. And then I was going to head home and just sleep it off for a few days. And I had prayed that morning to my grandmother saint, the Virgen de Guadalupe. And I went to her botanical, her spiritual shop, I guess. Anyway, where her saint was. And I put an offering there, put a little money. And I just remember thinking, and I remember I prayed that prayer, God help me. And I was just like, I was so lost. And I was in such a dreary desert that as Super Day likes to say, I was in between surrenders. And that night, after having one more for the road, I ran my car into a woman's house, into her front porch, and the front porch caved in on the car. And nobody was hurt in the house, but it had come to this. My drinking had come to this. I couldn't see. I could not see anything in front of my eyes because it was blacked out. I could hear what was going on. I remember reaching under my seat, which I had a lot of, as Julie likes to say, side dishes. I had a lot of side dishes. I was trying to push those side dishes into my nasal cavity to wake up. And the next thing I knew, my window was being broken and I was being pulled out of a car, my car. And I had boxers, some Gucci flip-flops, and a tank top t-shirt. And I was arrested with 5 felonies and 3 misdemeanors, all in one stop. It was very clear where alcohol and drugs had taken me. I remember being in the police car and the police officer saying to me, "Are you okay?" I think he said something like, "Do your parents know where you're at?" Like, he felt sorry for me in the back seat because he knew how much trouble I just got in. And I went to the detention center. And I went through booking, which is humiliating. And I went through the booking 3 times, you know, before I got sober. And, there's nothing more sobering than coming out of a blackout in like a 20 degree cell with all these deplorables. Me being the main deplorable out of all of them, just FYI. Anyway, so I get checked into my suite or my cell, and I remember thinking, it has come to this. You are in a lot of trouble. How are you going to backpedal out of this one? And so this is what it looked like for Thanksgiving, and that was the night of the arrest was Thanksgiving Eve, and I was not on the best terms with my family, and I didn't want to hear anything they had to say, and my job was to bring the desserts. I had a car full of desserts and a lot of outside dishes in my car, and when I got arrested, my car was towed with all those desserts in it. It was beautiful when I picked up my car from impound, but 11 o'clock, we were supposed to eat at 11 o'clock, and I didn't show up. 11:30, oh, cell's just late, give them a text, give them a call, 12, let's just begin eating. 12:30, 1 o'clock, where's cell? We need to start calling the hospitals. I ruined Thanksgiving, and I was located in the system, my parents were informed that my bond was $225,000. That's $22,000 to bail me out of jail. And, And then my dad went to work as a good Al-Anon. He went to his resources. He went to family and friends and said, we need to get him out of there as a good Al-Anon would. And I was in there on lockdown for 30 days and I knew how to survive in there. I was taught how to survive. It was my very first time. And, you know, I loaded up on Star Crunchies and snacks, and I would throw them under the door, and the people that were taking psych meds would throw their psych meds under the door, and I was able to, you know, breathe easier, sleep a little bit longer in my cell. And it came to a point where they wouldn't put me with anybody else because I was up to some shenanigans in there. And I was doing push-ups and I was talking to the wall, and it had come to this again. And I remember saying that prayer that every alcoholic says before they get sober. I will do whatever you want me to do if you could just get me out of here. And I got out of there. And like literally in 3 minutes after saying that prayer, they're like, Zepeda, get your stuff. And if you've been in jail, that means get your shit. You're getting checked out. Go. And I went and I like, oh my God, my dad was there. I knew he would be there. He was there. He couldn't come into the jail. He waited into this car in the parking lot and hugged him, and we cried, and we both cried. It seemed like what seemed like forever. And I just remember just feeling that safety again. And I hadn't felt that in years. And he said, I remember this clearly. He said, God didn't put you through hell for you not to be of service. And I had no idea what he meant at the time. I just kept on going. Like, I remember saying, I need Dairy Queen. I need a chicken steak finger basket. And we went and I remember eating and I just thought, how am I supposed to stay sober out here? Cause I'm supposed to stay sober. I checked in every Thursday. You know, I had freedom. My dad kept a tight leash on me. And I'll tell you what it came for time purposes is that, after a year, and I was still like cheating the tests. Every time I'd pee in a cup, I would have this cover up and it would say that I was fine or whatever. And I did that for a whole year, and all my charges I went to court and it would say, my attorney was like, you're good. Just wait. We're good. You know, the last one came, and a week before my final trial date, I got arrested again for driving under the influence and a possession of something or other. And my attorney was like, in jail, I get to go, you know, to freaking court and lockdown in chains and an orange jumper and to get sentenced. And the district attorney who was doing his job gave me 22 years. 22 years. And because I get an arrest right before my final, it ended up being 26 years in state prison. And that is not what I signed up for. It has come to this. I remember saying, it's not too late. I can make a run for it if I get out of this court. If they say that and I can get out of these cuffs, I'm out the door. And my only people that were my champions in the courtroom were my dad, my mom, my sister who was pregnant, and her husband. And this is how God works in my life. That morning, the district attorney got the judgeship, which means that he became the judge of the adult Bexar County felony drug court program. And he plea bargained after my sentencing. He said, we're going to give you an option not to go to jail. And I was like, what? And he said, if you can stay sober and do this program successfully for 2 years, then you can walk away and you can close the door on your criminal background record in your court. And, but I'm going to expect big things from you because you're the first person on my docket. So you need to go get evaluated. You need to go to treatment, and then you need to check in with me when you leave treatment into my court. And I thought, holy crap, how am I supposed to stay sober? Like, I hadn't had a sober breath. I didn't do anything like that. You know, for 23 years, I didn't draw a sober breath. And I thought, man, so I get evaluated and they say, your bed will be ready in 10 days. And I thought, hot rock massage, thank God, heated pool. And I checked in with my PO. They unchained me. I got checked out. I processed out. I checked into with my PO directly from leaving jail. And he was like, you know, your bed will be ready in 10 days. You're good to go. Just stay sober until then. I said, that's not going to happen. I don't know how to stay sober. And he got on the phone. He gave me this queen, this drag queen. I've been sober 3 years, Robert Chavadilla. I remember he goes, hey, meet me at Starbucks at 5 o'clock. And my dad, I was like, hey, we need to go to Starbucks at 5 o'clock to meet this guy. And I met him there. And then he told my dad, I got it from here. I'll drop him off after the meeting. And then he took me into my first meeting at Club 12, the 5:30 meeting with low lights. It's kind of like the back of my office in here. Low lights. Nobody can really see me. I can kind of just, and then he made me raise my hand. It was my first AA meeting and everybody was talking to me and I was like, who are y'all? Anyway, fix my collar. Oops. All right. So I'm at Club 12. I pick up my desire chip, whatever that is. And, everybody's talking to me and I could not tell you how uncomfortable I was. And I just wanted to get out of, I wanted my paper signed. I wanted to get up out of there. I wanted a burger and I wanted a hot shower and I wanted a bed. And, my stepmother allowed me to stay at her house on the couch and he said, I'll pick you up at 6 a.m. And he called my dad and he said, I'm going to pick your son up at 6 a.m. and I'll drop him off at midnight every day until his bed is ready. And he picked me up at 6 a.m. and we went to the early bird. And then he made me do some service work and, I helped in the kitchen and I cleaned the bathroom and we made newcomer packets and then the 11 a.m. and then we would go eat lunch with all the old timers and, Butch and, Garland and all these like conservative Republicans. I thought, this is not what I signed up for. You know, like, we went skeet shooting and I was like, it has come to this. There's got to be something better than that. Anyway, I did what they told me to do because I didn't want to die. I didn't want to go to jail. And I did. 6 a.m., 5:30 p.m. meeting. They were doing a rummage sale. So we're picking up literally junk from people's house in this old beat up truck from some guy like Tic Tac or Duty Pop or whoever who was sober and doing service work. And it was like summertime and I was sweating and detoxing from God knows what. And we would go pick up stuff that members of Club 12 would donate for this rummage sale. And then the phone would ring and it would be somebody on the, CSO hotline and, or the Club 12 hotline and they need a 12 step call. And Robert would put me in this old junky car with no air conditioner and we'd go do a 12 step call on like people who were drunk. They were drunk. I was like, I'm not allowed to be around drunk people and I'm on probation. And he was like, shut up, get in the car. And I was like, oh my God. So at day 10, I was like, please, God, please tell me my freaking bed is going to be ready. And they were like, your bed is ready. And I go and I was like, thank you for everything you have done for me. But I'm going to get a treatment. So I go to check into my fabulous treatment center at Lifetime Recovery on Southton Road on the south side of San Antonio. And there was all these hood rats in there. And I was like, it looked really cute from the outside. And you drove up and I got out with my Louis Vuitton bag and my, you know, Ralph Lauren spread, you know, comforter. And, you know, I had my Gucci flip flops on. I had my best Banana Republic linen top on. And I go to fried hair, black roots, because I had no money. And I go to check in and they're like, yes. And I was like, I'm here to check into my room. They were like, you're in bed number 60. Go grab a bunk. Go grab a mat. A mat? What do you mean a mat? And I look in and there's 60 freaking bunk beds and there's 90 bunk beds on the other side. And I was like, oh, excuse me. Like, I don't think this is where I'm supposed to be. there's been a mistake. I need to speak with the owner. You know, I was a super Karen back then and I had no business being a Karen. So anyway, I go and my counselor comes in and she's like, yes. And she was like, I said, I think there's a mistake. I don't think this is the treatment center I'm supposed to be at. I had never seen a treatment center like that. And she said, oh no, you're in the right place. You're with drug court and Judge Ernie Glenn is your your judge, right? And I was like, yeah. She's like, get a seat. And I was like, but I have Gucci flip-flops on. And she was like, well, Gucci flip-flops don't keep you sober here. Go grab a bunk or I can call the judge. I was like, ooh. And I got my bunk and I sat down and I made my bed and I put my Ralph Lauren comforter on there and I put my Louis Vuitton up because they have a locker. Because, you know, these people want to steal from me on my all these expensive things that I have. Meanwhile, drug court takes my cars. They take my townhome. They take all the material items that were stolen from my house and they auction them off. I literally had what I was left with a birth certificate, an ID, and and two hefty bags full of my belongings. I had Louis Vuitton shades, but no place to live. I was homeless. I was in rehab. You know what I'm saying? It has come to this. And gosh, it's really hard to get humble. And I had been to 1,000 meetings, and I heard this woman come in at Lifetime Recovery, and she said this: if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired, have I got news for you. Come and join us in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then she explained what her disease was like. And then I'll never forget it because it was her heart jumped out and spoke to my heart. And she said, my addiction had me in a cold, dark forest. And in this forest, there was a speck of light. And every time I ran for the speck of light, the branches pulled my hair, ripped my clothes, and scratched my skin. But if I didn't get to this light, I wasn't going to make it. And when I got close enough, out came the hand of God, and it pulled me in where I was warm, and I was safe, and you guys took me in. And she continues and says, and just FYI, I had the exact same feeling, my first spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, like I did when I grabbed and I jumped into my grandmother's arms. And it just felt like I was home when she spoke. And I knew this woman had the solution for me. I absolutely knew that she knew how to stay sober and that her life was good because she was a nurse and she had these degrees and all this stuff. And she continues and says, and then God starts walking out of the forest, into the forest. And she's like, wait, I just got here, God. And he was like, give me your hand. Let's go find another one. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has been for me from the very start, from me coming in to the rooms. Rick Javaria did that for me when he picked me up at Starbucks. You know, Terry's son did that to me when he offered a seat for me at a meeting. Those old timers fed me. They gave me coffee with the lid on it. They did all that for me. And they were Republicans, for God's sake. Anyway, my point is that I hadn't had anybody offer me any kind of love from the world that I came from drinking and drugs and alcohol and addiction and backstabbing and lives being ruined. Like, let me tell you, it was refreshing to know that you guys just wanted me to stay sober. I found the fellowship and the sunlight of the spirit in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys told me to have fun, and I did step work, and I rolled my sleeves up, and I know my time's coming up. But I want to tell you that I did the work because you guys showed me it worked. I wanted to be part of this. I wanted to tap into this power that was going to give me a whole new life because you guys were living new lives. I heard your stories. I listened on the edge of my seat. You guys spoke to me. You guys gave me hope. I was in it to win it. I did whatever you told me to do. I cleaned ashtrays. I mopped that floor at Club 12. I don't care if this is what it takes to stay sober. I'm in it. I promise God and my grandmother that I will do whatever you wanted me to do. And I remember at 90 days sober in that treatment center, I would commenced. I didn't mess up once. You know, I did what I was told. I did what Bill T and all those divine 60, Rule 62 guys would come into the treatment center and carry the message and pass the ASCA basket. Like, that meant the world to me. Michael D would wear his big bright polo and he looked like me, and I just knew that he was carrying the message, and he had like 6 months sober and it looked so good on him, and I wanted it. I wanted it, and I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to get it, and I did. And I did. I put the work in. I trusted God. I did the work. I worked these steps. I was honest with my sponsor, you know, and at 90 days, I was given the judge checked in with me. He actually came to the treatment center and he said, I heard you're doing good things here. And I was like, he came and everybody's like, the judge is here. And I was like, oh God, what did I do wrong? What did I do? I screwed up. I'm going to go to jail. I didn't. I just was so used to being like that. Anyway, he said, I think that you should go into sober living. And I was like, I'll consider that. And then I talked to my sponsor and he was like, that means you need to go to sober living. I was like, yeah, but my dad's going to get me an apartment. We're going to get a new car. We're going to get all this stuff. Like, we're going to start up for new furniture. And he was like, you're going to make a decision when you leave here. And you're either going to do something completely different and give your dad a break with his cash and his credit. Or you're going to do the same thing and end up where you've always ended up. And that was a come to Jesus moment with my sponsor. And I knew he was right. And I told my dad, hey, like, I got to do things differently. I'm going to listen to my sponsor. I'm going to listen to what these people in Alcoholics Anonymous are telling me. I love you, but I got to do this over here. And he said, okay. And I was getting my stuff packed because I was going into a sober house. And I went to, I have like, how long, Miss Suzanne? Okay, great. I'm going to wrap this up. I went, my dad gave me a 92 Honda Accord that was like in my sister's garage. And he cleaned it up and it was, you know, and he was like, and he was there, my sponsor. This is cool when your family is there and then your sponsor, and then you go and commence and you walk across the stage at the state funded. I hadn't completed anything. And I walked across the stage and got my certificate and got my medallion. You know, like I completed something, you know, for the first time because you guys showed me I could. And I said, hey, sponsor, I need to talk to you. Like, my dad gave me this car. It's old. It's got hundreds of thousands of miles on it. It has manual windows. Just FYI, you know, he said, I need to get to meetings and something. But if you tell me that I can't have this car, I will trust you. And he's like, you can have the car on one condition, that you understand it's not your car. That's God's car. And your job is to go pick up newcomers for 365 days and take them to meetings, because that's how you're going to stay sober and you're supposed to do that. I was like, done. And I remember having my second spiritual experience after leaving the treatment center with the windows down, because I was saving money on air conditioning, with my two hefty bags of extra, extra large clothes in my car now, going to my sober house. And I remember feeling like, the sun was setting. It was October. You know, it just felt right. It just felt like God was rolling my wheels to that sober house. And I knew that things were going to be okay. And I checked into my sober house and, you know, I started doing service work. And then that is the pinnacle of where my recovery is. Because I've been sober and, you know, I've been able to do so many beautiful, awesome things. And because I went to meetings when I didn't want to go, and because I sponsored people who I didn't want to sponsor, I stayed sober. You know what? Like, I got to, at 3 years sober, I was co-hosting the hospitality suite for the LGBT hospitality suite at the world freaking conference with 60,000 alcoholics, you know, reciting the Lord's Prayer in the Alamo Dome all at one time. It's another spiritual experience, you know, which leads to a spiritual awakening. I can't tell you in words what that feels like. I can only tell you that you come and keep coming back until the miracle happens. You never know when that's going to be. Okay, I'm going to roll this up. I'm going to talk some big truths, and that is At 6 years sober, some stuff came to the top. It bubbles up. When you do step work, more will be revealed. And I was told to do some work. And I did some work around my mother. And I had some memories that came up that I didn't know that were there. And I did the work. And I went, and it was outside issues. And I sought therapy. And I learned how to forgive my mom. And that was so tough. You know, I talked to my aunts and I was like, I was so mad at her, you know, that she treated me like this and blah, blah, blah. And then my aunt said, your grandmother told me to hold this letter for you. And this, it was a letter from my mother that she had written my grandmother. And she said, you'd be asking for this one day and this is the time to give it to you. And it said, my birth mother writing this letter to my mother. This is the hardest letter I am going to write in my life. It is the hardest thing I'll ever have to do. But I'm turning my child family because I cannot give him the love that he deserves and your family can. And I was able to read that letter and make peace with my mom. So if you're a mom out there, you don't think that's going to happen, it's happening. You know, my mother had passed away at her funeral. And you know what? I'm cool with that. I'm cool with that because Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to do that. The steps, the tools to forgive her and that she was just like us, you know, and that she was doing the best that she can. I became a real estate agent. I became an apartment locator. I got my broker's license because I wanted to open my own business. And you guys showed me how to do that, even with felonies. I'm not supposed to have licenses. 42, I went to school. It just seemed like where God wanted me. And being on the firing line, it's anonymous. I love going to detail. I love the, those are the ones I'm like, Hallie, this. You know, and then I introduced them to, you know, Julie WW, their grand sponsor, and we're like, let's go do this. Come on. You know, the lights are on, the coffee's made, come take a seat. You know, I'm working on my third degree right now, and I'll get to walk the stage for the second time, the third time in my life. And it is not easy. There's a lot of things I have to do and overcome to be teachable. This is what I get to do. I want to end at this is that, I got to, this is what I do every Thanksgiving. Cause this is my, what it's like to suit up and show, as a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous with integrity and grace and steadfastness. These are the characteristics I get to describe myself like, which is awesome. Is that I get to my mom, my sister, my mom have this big house and my dad built them. Part of his amends process in Canyon Lake. And I get there early. I've been doing this every year since I got sober. And I bring the desserts and I help mom finish the rest of the fixings in the house. And I set the table. I play with my niece and my nephew who I love so much, you know, and I, me and my sister do Snapchats and funny, goofy stuff. And then we feed everybody, and after everybody's done, I clear the dishes, and I wash every one of my mother's beautiful, you know, dishes and gold embroidered forks and utensils by hand because you guys taught me to do that. And then I help clean, and I sweep, and I mop, just like if I was at Club 12, and I put the chairs up and make sure everybody's got what they need to get, and then I give everybody a kiss, and I get to leave. And that's what a living in amends looks like. So when I stay up, I'm going to suit up and show up. And I do that because I've been given the grace of sobriety and I've been given the blessings and I get to do all these things today. And I will tell you that it's an absolute miracle that I am sitting here in front of you. And so are y'all. If we're all here right now, we're all miracles. And I know that. Today, what keeps me connected and centered is that I never forget what it's like to wake up in a jail cell. Come to. I never forget what it's like to look at 26 years in prison and your whole life flash in front of you. I never forget that. If I got what I deserved tonight, I wouldn't be able to say, thank you for my sobriety. My name is Cell, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. That's all I have.